Show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Juicebox Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan. That's right. You've landed in Juicebox Radio. That's CITR 101.9 FM. I'm glad to be in the box all by myself tonight. Except, no, actually, I have a guest. But my sweet little Caroline, she's not with us tonight. She's working for some good money. So you'll welcome her back next week. And last week's show actually touched on how to keep your long-term love life and romantic and erotic energy alive in your relationships. I kind of call it preventing bed death of all kinds. A lot of times the lesbians have coined the bed death term, but I think it happens to all of us at different times in our relationships. So last week's show is all about creating that erotic energy. This week, we're going to take a turn inward and discuss the secret life of babies. Now, you might be wondering, who wants to talk about babies, and what does this have to do about sex, except for that's sometimes what happens when you have sex is you make babies. But we're not going to be talking about that so much. Our guest tonight, Dr. Mia Califf of EmergingFamilies.com, and you can pull that up right now, EmergingFamilies.com, has published a book called The Secret Life of Babies. And her website states, research is beginning to show us that the environment we are conceived into, grown and birthed into, as well as the environment of our first year of life, dramatically shapes habits we form in our health and our well-beings. And a little snippet from her book, which I think is beautiful, it says, secretly, in small pockets within hospitals, birthing centers, therapists' office, schools, homes, and communities, a movement is stirring, a remembering. The re-examining of how we bring children into this world has started. Questions are being asked in the face of some of our most troubling times in the history of human birth and culture as a whole. As leading-edge scientists, therapists, birth supports, doctors, and parents continue to gather in far too small numbers to discuss the future of our culture, you are invited, the public, to consider the power you have to shape a road of peacefulness, contentedness, where all children are supported to live in their authenticity right from the beginning. So we're going to be taking calls tonight, of course. Feel free to call in and contribute to the conversation we're going to be having with Dr. Mia Califf. And that's at 604-822-2487, 604-UBC-CITR. Welcome, Mia.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks for coming. So why bother talking and thinking about babies?
Well, before I answer that, I just have to say I should probably hire you. That was such a great reading. Thank you.
Thanks. I've read a lot in all these decades of trying to get my life together here and get educated. So, yeah, I've gotten really good at reading. Thank you.
Yeah. So why bothering with babies? It's a good question. Unless you have a baby in your life or you're about to have one come into your life, why would you even be thinking about it? It's not sexy. Babies don't make us money. They slow us down.
They take away our libido oftentimes.
It's designed that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all this talk in culture about women being embarrassed about having a biological clock, and guys don't want to appear sappy or too soft if they're good with babies. So it's a great question.
Yes, thank you. So why are you thinking about babies so much? What happened with your process there?
Well, years ago, when I started studying chiropractic,
that's what the doctor name is from, Dr. Califf.
That's where I fetched that one from.
Okay, yeah, we're going to talk about your credentials in just 1 minute, so yeah.
I started noticing that there's a connection of emotions when it comes to health, that pain and disease isn't just a physical problem, that there are sometimes roots that are chemical, there are sometimes roots that are emotional, and that led me down this path of exploration.
Okay, so the credentials that you have, I mean, you have a doctor, that's pretty big stuff. So where did you get that from?
Well, there's this website.
Yeah, cheap through Thailand?
Yeah. I went to school here at UBC, and through my own exploration on my health as a young kid getting injured all the time, I thought I might become a sports medicine specialist, and then thought about physiotherapy, but chiropractic seemed to be an interesting avenue, and quite honestly, I don't know why I took that route, except that I knew it would give me the stepping stones to do what I do today. So that was a program I studied, and then started getting interested in craniosacral therapy and used that as an adjunct, and then getting into perinatal therapy as well.
Is that where a lot of the craniosacral therapists, that they're doing some of that work on newborn babies, or... Like I kind of been seeing craniosacral a lot, and I don't quite know what it means. And
yeah, it's kind of funny how it all fits together. I think what we've discovered and noticed as practitioners is that when people are in a safe and supported environment, they inevitably start to resolve the impact that their earliest experiences have had on their health. And it almost seems like a natural outcome of being in that environment.
In that safe and comfortable environment, which is something that I think you probably provide. I mean, I had the privilege of sharing dinner with you before the show. So, and when I first met you on the drive, you just made me feel instantly connected and comfortable, actually. So I can see that probably the people that you work with, you do create that safe and comfortable space where stuff starts to come up. And which makes you a great therapist and a good doctor. So we're talking about babies tonight and some of the far-reaching effects that come from the perinatal period. So for our listeners, what is this perinatal period? What do you mean by that?
The perinatal period is actually a term that was coined by an eminent obstetrician in France named Michel Audin. He was one of the first people who brought water birthing back into style.
All about water birthing. I had a friend who birthed her little girl. Beautiful story. It was amazing. It worked really well. I may try it myself if I ever get there.
So he was a revolutionary kind of guy and basically got the whole country of France to get back on the system of natural childbirth.
And so laboring and delivering without the medical, in like hospital, laying on the back and having it be like covered with cloths and, you know.
I can't actually speak for what he encourages day to day there, but I'm imagining that he encourages women to make the choices that support them the best.
Okay.
And so the term perinatal period, which he coined, defines a period of time that begins at conception and ends at the end of the first year of life. So we're looking at all the days, months, and all the days, weeks, and months that consist of those very, very early times as being influential into how health develops.
Okay, so just as an example, when, you know, I mean, you see a lot of hype in these days around folic acid, for example, and women that want to conceive getting on folic acid before they actually get pregnant, and how that, you know, implicates the spine and the brain, and obviously those things are very important to our health and our bodies over our times, our nervous systems, etc. So are you talking on that level, or mm-hmm. are you talking also, like, I'm thinking like spiritual stuff, like energetic memory things, like whatever the mother's going through. What about the father? Like, what mm-hmm. about the biological father? Who, what's his sperm carrying, or is that mm-hmm. just pure DNA? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I can kind of see the womb being full of all kinds of chemicals of maybe a stressful mother who, you know, who's got life and all of her kind of chemicals in her body or memory. But how is maybe the sperm getting in there, I wonder, and how is it affecting, do you think?
Well, it definitely gets in there.
Burst that egg right in half and starts creating a whole new person, right?
Yeah. Well, I get into this question. It's a great question you're asking. I get into it in great detail in the book. Certainly there are, in my mind, three important dimensions of influence in utero, let's call it. One of them is the obvious chemical aspect, which, you know, you're talking about folic acid. You want to boost your health, your immune system, as best you can before conceiving.
Certain vitamins and minerals mm-hmm. and et cetera, yeah.
And just food, you know, good food. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's an element of emotional...
well-being.
Emotional well-being. And what... emerging families is looking at is getting people to pay attention to some of the habits they picked up in their families and perhaps in generations before, and what they're passing down even unknowingly, and thinking about how to clean some of that up and refine it before going into the next generation. So there's that emotional component, which actually does end up affecting us physically.
Wow.
And that's a heavy one. A lot of people, it's tough to wade into without support.
Yeah, I kind of, I mean, I'm thinking the therapy that we all, I mean, some of us who choose to wake up in our lives and work on ourselves and deal with our past and maybe even the generations of our past, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, some of us, some people in this world are working hard to do that and to clear their energy bodies and their emotional and mental state and, you know, get kind of... well as possible mm-hmm. Before they go down that path. But
you mentioned about genes. Is it just about genes? And one of the interesting yeah. studies that have come out recently, Bruce Lipton is one of the most popular I think he's a PhD in biology. I think what he's talking about is that we come into being with far more genes and far more nerves than we actually need, which is interesting. We're actually endowed with way too much than we're actually going to apply to our growth. So what's interesting is that they've found that our environment dictates which genes will get expressed and which mm. ones won't. Mm. So to say that we are just a bundle of DNA and we're expressing what's come before us and we're stuck with what we've got, I think is an old concept, and it's mm-hmm. been useful for mm-hmm. as long as it's been useful. And mm-hmm. what we're figuring out is that actually we do have some influence.
Yeah.
And not just into what kind of genetic profile we'll be born with, but how we express our physiology throughout life and how we can right. transform it.
Well, I just want to quickly throw in an example of what I understand is just through relationship, for example, with, you know, if you're in a, you know, say you take two identical twins, you know, the studies there I think are really quite revealing about what's nature versus nurture. And if you're in a relationship that you're being nurtured and you're, you know, you actually will create pathways in your brain and in your physiology and everything like that to do with your physiology and your emotional body and everything that create a certain person, you know, and then as a genetic exact, you know, DNA exact person, you know, the other twin in a relationship that's been sort of abusive or at least, you know, suppressive in some way, physiologically is completely different. Their heart cells are different, their brain cells are different, and they actually have completely created a different person based purely on how they were treated. You know, the twins that were separated mm-hmm. at birth kind of thing, mm-hmm. different families, different relationships. So just as an example, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I read up on. So I totally hear you, and I'm just sort of applying that to another element of what you're talking about mm-hmm. so as an example. So, okay, I think The Secret Life of Babies, the book that you've published, is fascinating, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself. And I'm thinking that it's very well researched. So I just want to see some of the studies that you've read in the early years that compelled you to do this work, or some of the studies that you speak about in the book. Fascinating stuff. I mean, I just have a huge list here. You've done a very good list on your website, emergingfamilies.com. Incredible bibliography that you've put together here. I'm fascinated to read some of the just the studies themselves, let alone your book. So do speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks.
You can imagine my surprise going along in practice, just noticing that people were healing as soon as they had an opportunity to revisit challenging circumstances from their early life. I noticed that was working. It was totally to my surprise that science had already been looking into this for a while. One group of studies that I talk about in the book come out of Sweden. There's a researcher there called Bertil Jacobson, and he did about 7 or 8 studies between the 1980s and 2000, and he conducted a series of studies looking at issues facing present-day drug addicts and for those who had committed suicide after 1940. And in one study, he took 200 amphetamine addicts born between 1945 and 1956, and he found a correlation between addiction and their mothers having been given nitrous oxide, which is otherwise known as laughing gas, an anesthetic at birth. And when I started hearing this,
wow.
On one hand, I guess I wasn't surprised, but I was shocked that medical researchers were actually bothering to ask these questions. And then he went on for years doing similar studies, which confounded the evidence, some of which I'll mention. In another study, he took 200 opiate, which are like heroin or opium addicts, and they found to have a correlation between their mothers being given opiates and nitrous oxide at birth and becoming addicted later in life.
Wow, okay.
To addictive substances. And then the question was raised, well, what if they were just in so-called, you know, bad neighborhoods, or they were under the influence by osmosis of their communities? What if that was actually the confounding factor and not at all had to do with birth? So, of course, in his, you know, thorough style, he went on and did another study that excluded the factors of socioeconomic status, neighborhoods, and he found that, yes, still there were statistically significant correlations between...
Wow.
Mothers being under those influences at birth, and later challenges people were facing with addictions. And then to top it all off,
interesting.
And I know that this has far-reaching implications, and I'm not wanting to be alarmist to mothers who use pain support during birth, because it doesn't have to be that your child turns out to have drug addictions. It's just something to keep in mind. But the most shocking studies that he did do were with the suicide victims. And here's what he found. He discovered that the way victims killed themselves was correlated to birth interventions that they experienced while being born. So, i.e., if someone happened to kill themselves by asphyxiation, they had been asphyxiated. Statistically significant numbers were asphyxiated at birth. If they died by violent means, like jumping in front of a bus or shooting themselves, it was related to mechanical birth trauma.
So like the forceps?
Forceps, vacuum extraction.
Cesarean?
Possibly cesarean, although it's a slightly different.
Peaceful.
It doesn't have to always be a violent birth when birth interventions are used, but in...
Sometimes it can be.
Hospital practice have changed a lot over the last few decades. There's certainly a different conscientiousness now. And then death by drug intake or poison was related to drug administration at birth. So I read this and I thought, my gosh, you know, there aren't enough people who know this, and it's in the literature. We've got to, you know, share this with people that are in positions of influence and policymaking power. So,
which is great. Mm-hmm. So now that you're informing me and the thousands of listeners of Juicebox, hopefully there'll be some people listening that may take this up, read your book, start to get on the bandwagon. So what other studies? This is fascinating to me. I'm just applying it to my life, going, oh.
So that's some of the most extreme literature that I just felt I had to share with people. Not to say there aren't solutions for it, but then what was also really interesting
We're going to talk about the solutions in the second half, everybody. Hang on for 10 more minutes.
It was really interesting looking at animals and how they responded to, you know, in some cases, accidental experiments on the way they were birthing. And, you know, these kinds of experiments just sort of happened when people were farmers or, you know, growing their own livestock. already back in, you know, the early 1900s. But all through the previous century, people were noticing that if you routinely interrupted birth, whether it was an ox or a lamb or cows and rats, what would happen would be that if you took the child, the offspring away from the mother right after birth, which interrupted the mother being able to lick the calf clean or lick the pup clean, she wouldn't recognize the offspring as her own and then would not nurse the offspring and would not care for it afterwards. Mm-hmm. If she was allowed to lick the offspring, clean them, and do all sorts of those postnatal practices that are instinctual for them, what the researchers noticed that even if you separated the offspring for a while afterwards, they would still recognize the offspring and welcome them back.
So that bonding.
Mm-hmm. So there's something significant about letting nature play itself out that has lasting effects on us and the way we bond for the rest of our lives, especially with our parents, and then probably later the way we seek out love and intimacy in life, what's familiar to us, which I get into a lot more
In your book. Fabulous. I just want to interject with a study I just read today on the Shiwei Project, which is happening in Vancouver in our downtown east side, which for listeners that are international, you know, the poorest neighborhood in the lower mainland in Vancouver, you know, the third most beautiful city in the world. We're famous for our downtown east side being so poverty-stricken and drug-addicted and an open drug scene there. And they're doing, the Shiwei Project is enabling women that are pregnant and having children to support them in every way, shape possible to bond with their baby, to have their baby, because usually just whisked away, like back, you know, not even very long ago, just as soon as you see a woman in the downtown east side and she's pregnant having a baby, they just whisk the baby and take the baby, assuming that the woman is addicted and not able to care for the child. So there's no bonding that happens, and now they're doing these studies where they're allowing the mom and baby to stay together and not applying the methadone to the addicted, you know, baby if maybe the baby's just, you know, crying, whatever. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. I don't know if you've been reading up on that, but my new job today just started. I just was reading this today and was like, oh, this is good. You know, they're enabling that bonding to happen. I think it's really critical. And, you know, the mothers are, of course, staying more clean and more sober and wanting, because the bonding has happened, they've been enabled to, you know, stay with their baby in the same room and be nursing it. And unless there's HIV, they're letting the moms nurse, even if they've been on the drugs and whatever, but just letting that bonding happen. And
glad to hear about that. I feel encouraged with that.
Yeah, I was just, and so thank you for letting me go on about my information there. But yeah, so again, the studies, this is why I'm so intrigued to read your book, because I like to do research-based teaching in the world myself. So anything else that compelled you that you've been moved by in this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think listening to mothers has really awakened me.
So in your practice?
In my practice, mm-hmm. and also when I sometimes do conversations, let's call them, or lectures with postnatal groups. And what I'm inspired by with mothers is that their instincts are so accurate when they go into this phase of pregnancy and parenting. It's like something awakens in them that was perhaps dormant or latent. And what I find is a challenge out there is there's so much information about how to best, you know, be pregnant, how to best birth a baby, what's right, what's wrong. And no one can really make the decision for women. They have to follow their gut. And when they're afforded that opportunity and people trust them and support them, they do a magnificent job. And whether that's in the hospital with nurses and obstetricians using pain support, whether that's at home, women are quite inspiring because they know what they need. And so
if they listen,
if they're supported,
hear,
I think women naturally listen when the people around them trust them. So I'm pretty inspired by the women. Yeah.
Awesome.
Uh-huh.
So it is an exciting time in history. I think we're learning more than, as you say in your website, we've ever known about what babies experience, what they respond to, what they remember, even from inside the womb. How does this very critical period, this perinatal period, from conception to the, you know, first birthday, first year of babyhood, inform things that you think that play out in our present day lives? Can you give us some examples of how of how that happens in today for people that might be listening that are thinking, mm-hmm. well, I'm not ever going to have children, but I'm interested to know how it is that I'm affected. And mm-hmm. some, do you have some examples?
Well, what I started noticing when I started paying attention to the possibility that the perinatal period, I call it recapitulates or plays out again and again through life, was I started noticing on a really general level people's figures of speech. I don't know if you've ever used terms like I feel stuck or I feel like I'm between a rock and a hard place. And what would be your terminology?
I've used both of those.
Me too. Or a lot of people talk about not having enough room to breathe, uh-huh. being under pressure.
Yeah.
And then, but if you physiologically look around their bodies, there's a lot of oxygen, there's a lot of space, there's some visceral experience. People are remembering when the stakes start to raise. And I got curious about that, and I started even looking at music lyrics. And again, I talk about this in the book. Amazing how many lyrics metaphorically speak about being in what could be interpreted as a uterine environment, like our local heroine, Sarah McLachlan, for instance. I wonder if she's listening. She has this, one of my favorite songs, actually,
sure
Black and
is.
White. I'm sure she is, yeah. She has the song Black and White. I can't remember which. I think it's off of, can't remember which album. But she literally...
She's got like 20 of them for the song.
You can look that up. The lyrics go something like, I'm wound up small and tight, black and white, unravel this distant cord, the outside is forgotten. Like, and I just started thinking about it. Like, wow, she's describing a place and a time that sounds a little bit to me like an umbilical cord in a tight, dark place. And on and on. So I think that people are often trying to tell their stories when they don't really have all the words for what they remember, because you have to remember that if we are to remember our experiences from this period of time, they come before we actually have language skills. This is all under the age of one. So sometimes the way we remember them is metaphorical. And I think a lot of people end up trying to describe the memory of the experience or what they're being reminded of mm-hmm. from the past and the present mm-hmm. by using words that describe the original experience.
Right.
So that's one kind of, that's up for grabs. I've just been noticing that one.
That'd be a hard one to mm-hmm. grasp.
I don't know if people can measure. Oh, I guess they could do a study where they correlate birth, origins and how people remember, describe their present experiences. But then there are styles of intimacy that tend to reflect our early experiences, i.e. like if people...
I was going to say that it sounds like a style of intimacy, just what you were describing, because we need to take a break. So I want to the listeners are going to have to keep tuning in for this discussion on intimacy. But I just sort of close the half hour that I think, the twins I know a lot of twins, and they're probably some of the most ambivalent, intimate connectors that I know of, I think, because they were sharing womb space. Mm-hmm. And so they want so much freedom that, any kind of commitment or whatever is really hard for them. Any mm-hmm. kind of deepening of intimacy and commitment is hard for them. I don't know. Then, yeah.
Or maybe they have everything they already need.
Maybe they have everything. Yes, okay.
Who knows?
I've got my lens. I've got my filter. So it's encouraging, though. I think from what I understand of your work, Mia, is that it's never too late to begin the repair process, right? With even the most unwanted and difficult experiences that you may have experienced from your perinatal period and your childhood. I would like to say that I think I probably had a pretty traumatic, perinatal period and, early childhood. And it's not something that I've worked with for a long time. And I know a lot of people as well that share similar stories and have also come a long way, as I think I have. So it's good to know, anyone listening, that it's never too late and you can always begin your healing process. So we are going to talk about solutions in the second half of the show. You are listening to Juicebox on CITR Radio, 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Mia Califf, thank you for that, and we will be back. Keep that dial locked, and we welcome your calls during this time. So call in at 604-822-2487, and speak to Dr. Caleb herself. Thanks for listening.
Juicebox is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Juicebox Radio. Tonight we are speaking to Mia Califf of EmergingFamilies.com and author of The Secret Life of Babies, which is a scientific and therapeutic exploration of the nature of infant consciousness and how challenging experiences between conception and the first year of life shape the way our health and the ways of loving and being in relationship develop over our lifetime. So, very fabulous, wonderful guest. I'm super excited. I always forget to tell what kind of music was on, so I'm going to have to say.
I really enjoyed that song.
That was from the Supreme Beings of Leisure, their 2008 album just released out of New York. And the song was called The Light, which I think was a good choice considering what we're talking about tonight. Coming back into the light. So we're talking about the solutions to perhaps maybe not the most ideal perinatal period of, you know, or perinatal experience of your life. So we're going to talk about solutions. So we already know that if families, as you talked about earlier in the hour, can receive the proper support through rest, through time together, through naturally grown food. And I think you were speaking quite a bit about the emotional support of their community, of their professional practitioners that are in their lives, trusting these families and these women to do what they need to do, makes the journey easier, makes it more enjoyable, makes it better for the baby, for the infants. So we've sort of talked a little bit about that. What you do in practice, so you do therapy, you do workshops. Can we talk about some of the, maybe we'll give a case study, for example, first, and then we'll talk about how you experience like the therapy and what people do in the workshop and what happens in consultation, et cetera. So can you give an example of maybe somebody that's come to you with an issue or how you've handled it?
Yeah, so the work I'm doing is divided into two groups, one of which is young families, people that have just had a baby or are planning on it. And then the other group are adults who are looking backwards at their earliest times and okay. wanting to resolve effects on them. So why don't we start with what an adult say would be dealing with and
sure.
go from there.
Mm-hmm.
Case study. Let's take a woman that came to me. We started off with one-on-one sessions, and she was noticing that anytime she became excited, engaged, or was partway through a project, she found herself really nauseous with an incredible headache and disoriented. And it would last sometimes for a while. And
that sounds like me.
Oh, maybe it was you. It incapacitated her and interfered with her being able to execute a task. And the greater the significance of the task to her, the higher the stakes, the more exacerbated her symptoms were. Now, she didn't come to me with any awareness that this was had a root. She came to me because she wanted to get out of pain of having AIDS headaches.
Okay.
And what happened in the session was she... I did an assessment on her. What I'm looking for in people's bodies are restrictions in their tissues, like where places in their body that just don't seem, where tissues are gliding smoothly against each other. And that could be in the brain and spinal cord, that could be in muscles or in organs or in the bones. And what I noticed in her was a vice-like grip across her temples and a habit she had in her nervous system to lean to the left all down her body. And you could see that when she was walking, you could see it in the way she moved.
I know somebody who does that all the time. Weird stuff, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. I think we all do. We all
have a nervous movement.
And when I talked to her about it and talked to her about her early times, she didn't really have much information. But when we actually started the session, and what happens in a session is people, again, in the safe and sort of supportive environment, with the right amount of pressure on their bodies, will actually pull into the positions reminiscent of positions they were in when they first absorbed an injury.
Okay.
So she found herself naturally pulling into a position that had her leaning down to the left and her head twisted and a lot of pressure building up in her head. And I wasn't using a whole lot of pressure, but she was starting to recount something that had almost been recorded in her tissues.
Right, right. No, I've heard about this a lot, this things, yeah, when you press on something as a therapist and then memories come up and yeah, mm-hmm. I've heard about that. It's really cool.
So the felt sense that she actually got in her body was a distinct, palpable, never before thought of feeling of having metal on her head and being, you know, forced ahead of schedule into birth. And, you know, when we talk about memory, this becomes quite controversial, because when scientists and psychologists, psychiatrists talk about memory, we don't think of having the brain architecture to support it prior to being age three, prior to being verbal.
Right.
But
brain architecture, I like that.
Yeah. Truth be known, we are able to record memory in our tissues, and then we don't need the brain support. We don't need the brain architecture to support it. There is something that gets recorded in cellular memory.
Of course.
And this woman exemplified it. And what ended up happening was, as soon as she was in the most contracted position like this, and we went very slowly and gently and, you know, talked through it the whole time, once she realized that the heartbreak that she was carrying with her from that experience wasn't, you know, the fact that she was born by forceps. I mean, who cares, you know, one way or another.
You do what you need to do if you're going to save the baby, whatever, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what she was carrying around with her was this sense of impending doom of when she went to birth herself, i.e. when she went into doing a completion of a new project, wanting to... birth herself into being, a new project, a task. So what she discovered was she was never afforded the experience originally to do things on her own timing, at her pace, with her own velocity, you know, working with her mother to be born the way she would have wanted to. And what she discovered was is that the forceps weren't even necessary. She discovered that she could have done it on her own. That was her deep feeling in that moment.
Right.
And what happens to people when they're in that experience is, as soon as they get the nugget that has been locked inside them for all that time, that heartbreak or whatever it was, that lost moment, that lost possibility, all the tissues that have been rallying around that injury suddenly dissolve their tension. Mm-hmm. And they come out of the position and usually don't need to go there again. They maybe have to do different camera angles of the same experience, or, you know, rework different belief systems they've developed from it. But the truth being known, they get to live like they would have been if that had never happened. Hmm. They don't forget it, but they relate differently to the memory of it in their bodies.
Wow.
So it's things like that. And to talk about it it can sound very abstract, because it is such an experience, and it's...
It's an experiential thing. It's a physical, emotional, intangible, you know, as far as scientific, like, whatever, like you're saying, you know, it's.
And the memory isn't like, oh, yeah, I remember that time I was.
The memory is
all of a sudden it's like you're right there. You can taste it. You can feel it. It's shocking.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I've done some NLP work, and I know that memories can be like you are right in the mess where phobias come from, too, you know.
Mm-hmm. So if you take that woman in, we were to put her in a process workshop, so take her out of a one-on-one environment and ideally go into a workshop environment, the process workshops I do. There are seven people, and the experience is about one evening in 3 days. People go home at night, and everyone gets a turn to work on an intention they have for their life, and they identify their intention based on something that they don't feel is working in their life, whether that's in their relationships, in their physical health, in their work, some place that they're
important
troubled.
To them and they're troubled or whatever.
But they're motivated by. And so their own turn lasts about an hour and a half to 3 hours, and everyone in the room is recruited to support the physical process and emotional process that the person goes through, and I facilitate it. And there's some very clear guiding principles that make it doable and safe for people to explore that. And it begins as a conversation and usually ends up as someone repatterning an early experience of theirs that they had never thought of or explored before. Or maybe did, but not in the same way. And people end up usually feeling quite a bit relieved afterwards and more able to be close to the people around them. And
not just in the workshop, but in their lives. You mean?
Yeah, and just more efficient.
More efficient, mm-hmm. I think, yeah. Trusting.
Comfortable.
Trusting life, comfortable in their own skin. And in their relationships. And sounds pretty powerful.
It sounds
pretty different from what I've seen and done a lot of these things in my life, and sounds really, really cool. I think I might have to take one of your personal.
What
I think 101 training would be probably good for me in some of these group things, but sounds very powerful.
What I like about it is that
it's a good
model. There's no agenda. There's no force. People guide themselves into where they need to go, and I just follow them.
Wow. Okay. So. I want to just read about something from what you're adding to this model of like being healthy, for example. I mean, these are some great solutions that you've proposed, and just for families and for mothers receiving the support they need to make the journey of being pregnant and in the first year. Like, I actually have a couple of friends right now that are pregnant, and they're both struggling a lot. So I'm going to be proposing that they listen to this podcast if they're not listening to the show tonight. So adding to this model, Mia, is that you say that the ability to differentiate the unmet needs that we have had as babies in the womb, as prenates, and as young babies. So can you speak to that? Experiences from these times that have affected us in ways that are so subtle and so ingrained that we sometimes don't have words for them. Can you explain that? We've been talking about that a little bit, but can we mm-hmm. expand on that?
Well, I think one of the clear examples goes back to those studies that I talked about that came out of Sweden. It seems that whatever experience we come into contact with during the perinatal period sets a marker for what is normal for us. And what we do is we go and we seek them out, those normals, again and again.
Gently and with compassion is what you...
Well, actually, what I'm saying is these people that become drug addicts or people that committed suicide, their first experience about the world told them it should feel like this, which was a drug imprint or a violent force imprint, in their head. Mm-hmm. And that got ingrained as their norm. That got ingrained as what their whole body and system began to orient around as normal. In the absence of that sensation, things feel abnormal.
Right.
In the absence of the chemical or the force or the pressure or the chemical, you know, whatever it is, mm-hmm. disequilibrium shows up. They feel out of sorts, even though for us looking in, we'd think, come on, you know, normal is pain-free. Normal is no
drug
chemicals.
Free, yeah. Mm-hmm.
For them, that's their norm. And you take fetal alcohol syndrome as an example. Those kids are going through withdrawal, and that's why they're shaking when they're born, is that they don't have the alcohol in their system, and they're going to shock without it. So the irony and the sadness of this is that people go and they seek to replace that sensation, whether they do it with a drug or whether they do it with a depressing relationship or
sex, whatever it is,
whatever will match the sensation closest enough for them. Kids with autism will often bang their head against the wall. They're showing you how much pressure they have in their heads, but the banging against the wall actually relieves the pressure in their head because mm-hmm. that's what they're living with inside them. It matches it. So what we're trying to do is give people a different experience,
mm-hmm.
one that their body would naturally have organized around. And it suddenly gives our nervous system an option to move towards. And it has to be done very gently and safely and gradually so that people... Because what we believe is that intact underneath those imprints is a fully intact system that is able to bond, able to love, able to live without the chemical or the pain.
Right. I mean, you talk about resolving the impact that difficult experiences have had on us from the perinatal period and early life, that we learn to effectively free ourselves from reactivity that's in our nervous systems, like you're saying, our immune systems and our emotions, and allow us to live more fluidly and more authentically. And I think it's beautifully written on your website. Now, I just sort of in the last few, you know, 5-6 minutes of the show, I want to talk about sexuality a little bit and sexual response. What you might think goes on there, what do you think has some, maybe a case study or maybe some examples around sexual response
mm-hmm.
in people today, like compared to what they're and when they're in infancy and how that has affected them?
Well, it's not, I'm not a sexual response specialist, but I would say the way we do one thing is the way we do all things. That's what I've noticed. And the way we, I like to call it sequencing. So the way we begin, experience the middle and end any task seems to be reminiscent of how we first started, did the middle, and ended our earliest experience as well.
Right.
So what I mean by that is, let's just say your birth got interrupted in a way that wasn't planned by you or your mom. sometimes the way we go to have sex or sometimes the way we go to do intimacy recapitulates those interruptions. We can only sustain connection without remembering that interruption where we kind of buck out of the sequence. Your eyes are rolling.
I'm like, I do that.
What do you do?
Again, I think I need a one-on-one session.
There's a hiccup in the nervous system that will happen again and again, no matter what sequence we engage in. So I believe that that translates into sexual behavior as well and expressions of intimacy. Mm. All the way from, and I don't think it's always literal. I mean, I know some people, let's say, who didn't get to spend a lot of time with their moms after they were born because they needed to be separated. And it was good for them because it was an emergency and they had their lives saved. They're craving contact and connection much, much more than someone who perhaps got to linger on their mother's belly after they were born and, you know, had all the time in the world to hang out together. So I'm not saying that people will, they often go one way or another. They'll go into hyperconnection or hyper disconnection.
Maybe a combination, depending.
Or a combination. Everyone is so unique. I hate to apply a textbook. I don't want to make generalizations in
every
a way.
Every story is very unique, yeah. And, of course, it changes, and every time you get into another relationship, you may bring similar patterns, but...
And it's interesting to see how they dovetail together.
Yeah, well, how... Yeah. Can you give an example of what you're talking about?
Oh.
The dovetailing?
Maybe you could.
Don't put me on the spot. yeah, I could think of an example. I just think that the way that we are in one relationship may bring out certain ways of being and sexual being. Of course, like you're saying, how we do sex is how we do our lives, and vice versa. How we do our lives is how we do sex. And so, you know, like you, I might feel really, you know, confident and released in some relationship, and that allows me to... allows a person to be more expressed and reach that edge where that hiccup might happen so that you can kind of get closer to it, or then you get into maybe get into the next relationship where you aren't as fully allowed to open, but then that hiccup will happen anyway. Is that kind of like it comes, I don't know if that's a good example.
We should draw a graph. Let's draw a graph and email it to our listeners.
I know. I love this. I know. I need some visuals, and I keep saying we need to have a video camera, and then I can just do a big
Well, let's talk
whiteboard.
About that girl with the forceps delivery.
Okay.
You know, the forceps showed up at the end of her birth, which was about 5 or 6 hours, which is a pretty quick delivery. You'd think that
That's
they'd
really
let her hang out and finish it. But at the last 3/4 of her sexual experiences, she wouldn't be able to stay connected to her partner or her sensations, and she'd go numb. So, you know, it shows up everywhere. It would probably show up, like she said, in her business practices, when she tried to finish a project, she'd go through a wicked headache. So,
That sounds fairly familiar with the hiccuping and the not finishing the projects.
This is sort of a human thing, and I don't think there's anything wrong with us. I think we're just extremely sentient. We pick up from our environments, and... unfortunately, a lot of therapy is buried behind a closed door, and we don't get to talk about what are some very common patterns, not only in us as individuals, but as cultures, the way
right.
we do war, the way we practice...
Business,
yeah. I mean, I don't think this just happens on us on a personal level. I think it happens as collections of communities and countries as well.
I have to agree. So what's next for you? Yeah, like what's happening with you? I mean, this is such a huge conversation, such a huge...
Well, my hope is that...
It's also very individual, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think it applies to all of us because we were all once babies, which I think we forget. So Secret Life of Babies isn't just about the little ones amidst us. It's about us as adults and as cultures. So it's almost a metaphor, like a baby is almost a barometer of our culture. Mm-hmm. So if anybody feels like... exploring more of this, there is a great conference happening in Nelson at the end of September.
Oh.
It's called Science Meets Our Hearts, and all of the leading edge professionals in this industry will be gathering and teaching, lecturing. It's also very affordable, September 25th to 27th, Science Meets Our Hearts, and I'm going to be giving a lecture there called The Family Field, talking about how these influences gather and culminate in a baby's life.
Sounds fabulous.
And there's also ongoing workshops, so if people think they want to explore this kind of work, they're welcome to email me
And emergingfamilies.com.
Emergingfamilies.com.
Easy to find. Great website name. Easy to find you. So you also mentioned something about this conversation that you and I have had tonight and how important it is to just make this kind of a conversation that you have with your families, with communities, with your friendships, with your partnerships, and have it be, as you said, as commonplace as a conversation that's happening today on ecology and how we're talking about saving the planet's ecology and how critical that is. So just in the last minute, like, how do we do that? Like, what kind of last minute comments might you add?
Well, because it's such a personal nature, this conversation, it strikes everyone in their own way. I would just invite people to go away from here thinking about what sparked in them and bring that spark into conversation with their friends, neighbors, family members, partners. I'm imagining if this becomes as commonplace in our attention as conversations on ecology, we're going to be that much further ahead when we go to explore how to create world peace, how to do any of the important things we need to do. Because if we can bring our babies into the world in the way that we wish to see the world, I think we're going to be transforming the planet within a generation. Mm-hmm. And it is doable. So I'm excited about that.
And of course, read The Secret Life of Babies.
The first 100 copies are free.
The first 100 copies are free from your website. We can find more information. Fabulous. Well, I have to thank you, Dr. Mia Califf. I really appreciate your time tonight on Juicebox.
Thank you.
And I hopefully will have you back. So we hope you enjoyed tonight's Juicebox Radio. If you have any recommendations for a show topic that you'd like to hear, or any questions with anything to do with sexuality or relationships, or even babies, whatever it might be, please feel free to email Julia or Caroline at juiceboxradio.com. So coming up next is Hans von Klotz's Misery Hour. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with. And I tell you, one of the best parts of turning this show from 8 o'clock on Wednesday nights to 10 o'clock on Wednesday nights was that I got to see him every week coming into the house. So listen up for Hans von Klotz's Misery Hour. And I will be back with the Dear Caroline next week. And thanks for listening. Just experience Juicebox Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual sexual health, expressing diversity, celebrating queerness, and encouraging pleasure at all stages. Be sure to tune into Juicebox every Wednesday night at 10. In the meantime, you can check out juiceboxradio.com. Thanks for listening.